Hello and good afternoon. Thank you to everybody for calling in today to our Venture Law Meetup webinar. My name is Leah Brownlee. I am of counsel at Squire Patton Boggs, and I am joined by two colleagues from Cleveland Clinic Innovations in presenting today a webinar on enhancing capabilities and accelerating pace to market. You know, talking about corporate partnerships and how they help move a company forward and the key factors to when the company needs to move into them and how they really move forward. My co-presenters are Chip Steiner and John Steiner, both from Cleveland Clinic Innovations, and I'll let them both introduce themselves.
Thank you, Leah. This is Chip Steiner, also known as Charles Steiner. I am a technology development director at Cleveland Clinic in our innovations group, focusing on external entrepreneurial engagement. And John?
Good afternoon. This is John Steiner. I work with our innovations program as well. I work on our relationships with large corporate entities and other healthcare providers who are interested in partnering with the Cleveland Clinic. We have an alliance program that I help manage, and through that alliance program, we work with both with entrepreneurs, technology development experts, and other large organizations on bringing medical devices to market. Before I worked in innovations, I also worked in our corporate strategy group and our Heart and Vascular Institute at the Cleveland Clinic.
And I mentioned I was of counsel at Squire Patton Boggs. I spend most of my time working with early stage companies, moving them through financings, corporate partnerships, et cetera, as they move through the life cycle of the company. And that's how I've spent most of my career for the last 15 years, actually starting about 15 years ago in Cleveland Clinic Innovations and then moving into the law firm, and also spending some time, about 6 years, at a small stage, a small biotech company. So, just a quick commercial. We don't do this alone at Squire or just with Cleveland Clinic, but we have a number of partners that help us present this webinar. And if you've listened to a series of them, you know they show up here and there as co-presenters. Help us with ideas for the webinar content and also in just distributing and spreading the word about the webinars. So from there, I'll turn it over to the guys from Cleveland Clinic and let them start the discussion.
Thank you, Leah. And for those that may have interacted with our office, our team, and are seemingly curious if John and I are brothers, well, today will be your brothers in innovation commercialization. We're reminded a few years back of the World Wrestling Federation and the Steiner brothers. We're still arguing over whether I'm Rick or he's Eric or Scott or whomever. We're just having fun with it. But today's going to be a tag team. We're going to kind of bring you through the innovation journey. And feel free, if you have questions during the seminar or afterwards, to reach out. This is meant to be a team sport in many respects. Jumping ahead, today's discussion is really to help those with an entrepreneurial focus on some of the best strategies for bringing an idea forward from conception to the marketplace. In addition, we'll discuss the advantages of partnering with various organizations, whether they're strategic and in the marketplace or they have aligned technology or commercial interests, and then a few perspectives from our experience on how the different industries work with us and can work with you if that's in fact along your commercialization pathway. So I start many of these discussions about the way, in fact, entrepreneurs think about the path to market. And for some, they see a very straight line approach from conception of a novel or impactful idea with a very short pathway towards commercial success. Those of you that have been in this game before recognize that that's overly simplistic, and in fact, the pathway is often multi-routed and not at all a straight line approach. We're going to talk today about why that is in many cases, but how to anticipate or predict some of the little cul-de-sacs that occur along that pathway and how best to take advantage of them.
Chip, I think all along the pathway that you're going to describe here in the first half of the webinar, there are going to be opportunities to think about ways of partnering. And so in the latter half of the webinar, we'll talk about when and where those opportunities make the most sense, both from the perspective of a corporate partner, but also from the perspective of an entrepreneur. So as Chip goes through and describes this innovation journey, there are going to be some call-outs later on in the webinar to areas that are particularly suitable for approaching a corporate partner, or in the inverse, areas where there are where it is particularly advantageous for a partner to be soliciting entrepreneurial ideas from the outside. So we'll be discussing some of that today as well.
That's perfect, John. Thank you. So as many of you think about either a past journey or one that you're planning, I wanted to call out a couple of steps along the way that are particularly critical. As you can imagine, you're not the only one with a new bright idea. In fact, many before and many in the future will be innovating because as humans, we face challenges in our workplace. Our group leverages a lot of those medically oriented folks to try to figure out where their unique solution might be most impactful. And understanding maybe the underlying impetus for that idea, whether it's because they found a more efficient way to deliver patient care, or they've identified some new technology that improves outcomes. It's understanding that impetus that you really want to focus on, because that's going to be a key to differentiating you in the marketplace. But recognize that just because you've got a bright idea, it may not move the market in any way, shape, or form. And you have to understand how that bright idea is most likely going to make that impact. There's often a desire to get out and start talking with potential partners or even future customers about your idea before you have secured appropriate protection for that intellectual property. And intellectual property varies from technology domain to technology domain. Certainly the software world has a different strategy than maybe the molecular or device world. And understanding what is the most appropriate way to protect your technology is something to consider. I'm currently at a meeting of technology innovators, and I'm taken aback by the number of folks that are freely sharing their approach to the field, and I don't think they completely recognize the amount of note taking that is occurring by industry out in the audience as they present their findings in the operating room or their findings in the clinical space. So be mindful of how to protect technology and to do it in a forward-looking perspective. Once you have protected, however, that's where guiding the right type of evidence gathering is critical. If you sit down with a potential player and you have your IP position well locked up, but you have no independent data to define what you've done, you're going to get a very different reaction, and perhaps a less valuable reaction than if you sat down across the table with a potential partner with good validation of your idea, validation that is drawn from the likely marketplace that you're going to be working in. So often in the clinical space, that involves some very academic-looking clinical validation studies, but it doesn't have to be. First in man, which is what's often thought of as the key inflection point, is not a prerequisite in many cases for having a substantive conversation. But having some clinical data, whether it's in an associated field, is a real enabler there. And then lastly, we want to talk about finding those strategic partners, either ones that have companion technology that you're going to leverage or they're going to leverage from you, and understanding what the market landscape looks like to figure out what that partnership should look like is a key consideration. Our team works with entrepreneurs along all this entire journey and sort of making sure we have things right-sized and in the right order, if you will. Partnering before you've got protection, doing clinical validation before you really know what your market is going to be can cause problems and actually can ultimately devalue the technology that you're trying to advance.
So, and this is Leah. I just want to give a little bit of kind of a legal overlay to the structure that Chip is describing. When a company goes out to look for a strategic partner, it's very often the strategic partner isn't interested in signing a confidentiality agreement. And that's why that protecting your intellectual property properly is a really key, important first step. And also why the picture of the patents up there rather than, you know, a trademark or a trade secret, you know, reference or something of the sort. So from a patent perspective, if you're going to go up at a conference like what Chip mentioned, and go and do a presentation, very often you can just file a provisional patent application without any claims, but with possibly your presentation attached. So that as far as the patent office in the U.S. is concerned, you are the first to file and that you did file before there was a public disclosure, thereby protecting the ability to get intellectual property protection on your invention, not only in the U.S., but also worldwide. If you're in the software field, you have to be a little bit more cautious, and I pick out software specifically because it's hard to get patent protection in the software area. And so that's where you get into the more broad talking generally rather than specific if somebody doesn't want to sign a confidentiality agreement because you're going to be falling back into trade secret protection. And then going out and talking to the strategic partner, you want somebody to sign a confidentiality agreement, but typically that strategic partner is a bigger company, and the process to get from I'm interested in hearing in your technology to I'm interested enough to go to my legal department and get their approval to sign an agreement to protect the confidentiality of your invention, isn't a week process. Sometimes it's multiple months, multiple meetings before the level of interest grows high enough that they will be willing to go through the process of signing a confidentiality agreement and learning about the confidential part of your invention.
Yeah, that's a great point. And at the Cleveland Clinic, I think we've seen both sides of that that play out. Obviously, this pathway that Chip has described here is a pathway that we use to shepherd the inventions and innovations that primarily come from caregivers within the Cleveland Clinic. That's what Cleveland Clinic Innovations was originally designed to do. And so when we would approach strategic partners with Cleveland Clinic technologies that we wanted to potentially talk to about a license deal, we would be on the one end of that conversation. But now, as Chip described, we provide a lot of these sorts of services for external entrepreneurs who want to approach the Cleveland Clinic and, let's just say, potentially would like to do a proper validation study. And so some of the external entrepreneurs are operating on different timelines than a large organization like Cleveland Clinic. And so I think your point is really well taken in terms of making sure that those legal documents are in order, but also having realistic expectations around timelines when you're dealing with organizations of different sizes and with different strategic priorities.
So let's jump in now to the four major areas we're going to discuss today. And these line very well with that stylized journey that we were just discussing. First and foremost, I want to emphasize, we put this first. As an entrepreneur and seeking to be successful in a market, you need to begin with a strategy session. You need to research and understand where the market is that your technology is most accelerating in, where they're most impactful. And that strategy will include not only the market assessment, but also the technology readiness for that market. Are you dealing with a standalone technology, or is it really something that's going to draft off of something that is necessary for your technology to be successful, but also already enjoys a lot of market share? So understanding what the where the fit is for your technology in the existing field, both technologically and business-wise, is a real critical aspect here. We're going to talk a lot about that. Coming out of that strategic research and planning, you're going to then be able to put together a cogent development plan. And this plan will be informed by the previous work, but also where you anticipate your greatest technology investment need is going to be. Following that, you're going to want to have the right team in place to execute on that plan that you laid out thoughtfully. And that team doesn't necessarily always have to be the founders or the inventors. That team could involve other strategic partners that you start to align. So anticipate where you should be leading most of the effort and where you should be leaning on other business colleagues in that capacity. And then lastly, when you're leveraging some of those partners, you want to look at everyone's incentives. Are they all in it for maybe one aspect of the technology, or do they see a long-term value to them and to the goals of the company or technology that the company is associated with? It's really critical to establish aligned incentives in this case, because you'll end up getting a lot more unintended value than you would have anticipated otherwise. So let's jump into these four areas, and I'll ask my colleagues to comment as well. If I can get the slide to advance. Hold a second. Looks like it's thinking about it on my end. Maybe if one of my colleagues could advance the slide.
It's there, Chip.
It's there. Okay, it's just not displaying for me. So as I think about the market need and the existing players, if you are looking in the heart failure space, or if you're looking in the orthopedic space, or you're looking in a workflow space in healthcare, you really want to know what the existing solutions are. And as I mentioned much earlier today, what does the technology look like what will the market look like, if you will, once your technology is fully adopted? Will you be driving greater volumes? Will you be driving greater outcome measures? Will you be, in fact, advancing the an aspect of patient care that is not currently available? What we're really driving at here is understanding where your technology fits in today's and tomorrow's marketplace. If you can anticipate where it's going to be, you can better design your plan to meet or exceed that plan. And when I think about really the most appropriate strategy, it's one where you're envisioning where you were yesterday before the technology was there and all the challenges, and you're thinking about a double-step approach where you're able to impact the future and also kind of lock in some of those gains for your future plans. I'm going to ask my colleagues to comment further if they can. My screen, unfortunately, is locked up at the moment.
Sure. What I'd add here, Chip, and thanks for that, is both the market need, the existing players, and the technology readiness components that we're talking about when we build a strategy, those components require both secondary research, which is something that one person can potentially do behind a desk and better understand market need, better understand volumes, but it also can require some primary research. So understanding impact on workflow, that's something we work quite often with external entrepreneurs on, because they may have, an invention that's designed to improve the speed of surgical closure or something like that. But depending on what level of expertise in the nursing community it requires and whether physicians are willing to try something new, those are the types of questions that can only be answered through doing some primary research. And so oftentimes, as I said, I work with our corporate partners, and our corporate partners are interested in, better understanding whether a given technology has a potential application in the healthcare market. One of the things that we do with those corporate partners is sort of key opinion leader workshops, where we review technologies and we understand both the current market solutions that are out there, but also what would the workflow implications be of disrupting those solutions in the way that some of our partners are suggesting. So as I said before, the tools and methodologies that we historically have used on internal Cleveland Clinic technologies, we started to deploy externally to the Cleveland Clinic when entrepreneurs come knocking. And that includes, especially in this early phase, before you get into piloting or validation, it includes doing the requisite research around market need and around what, in fact, you are disrupting with your technology.
And I'll just say quickly, from my point of view, you know, there's not a lot of legal overlay here, but from where I see this in a progression with a company or with a project is that, you know, determining what the workflow is and determining what the market need is, that may not be known on day one of a company or even, you know, after that. But what the company will know is hopefully, one, what they don't know, and they'll be able to identify that one of the projects going forward is determining the market need and potentially who they need to engage with to determine more than what they personally can sitting at a computer, and determining the cost to the company of doing that research. Because when they're presenting to, you know, a very early stage investor, if this is a standalone company, they need to tell that investor what they're going to do with their money and why their money is going to add value to the company. So if I'm asking, you know, a seed stage investor for $100,000 because it's going to cost me a certain amount of money to engage with Cleveland Clinic and with key knowledge, you know, people, then the result is that those key knowledge leaders and that report is going to come out in a few months after I'm able to pay, you know, sign the contract with Cleveland Clinic, start the research and really engage in that project, and then I'm going to be able to raise more money because I've added the value to the company. The company presumably is now worth more because I know how I'm going to get my product into the marketplace, and how it's going to disrupt or create money down the line for that company.
Oh, thanks, Leah. So if one of you would advance on to the next slide, I guess, execute plan. So first and foremost, yeah, thanks, John. First and foremost, as any good plan, you need to anticipate that you'll deviate from it. But without that that solid foundation, you won't know how much deviation is really occurring. But that plan is truly just a guideline. It represents your best estimate based on the state of technology and the state of the marketplace. And as you work to manage any deviation that occurs from that plan, you're really demonstrating your ability to adapt, and without a lot of delay, you're able to still impact and achieve the primary goals. And so I think when you're putting the plan together, you need to be mindful that it may be changing, but as you execute, you need to identify ways to improve upon the overall success metrics. Oftentimes, when you're following that plan, and you're identifying maybe some new opportunities along the way, you'll want to incorporate those and have the ability to perhaps adapt your goals to take advantage of shifts that might be occurring in that market. You can't deliver oftentimes your overall plan in a week's time frame. And so you have to expect there are other folks out there, there are other market forces that are going to change the way your objectives might be interpreted. So it's really critical that you have that flexibility and you keep your knees bent, if you will, to accommodate any unanticipated shifts that are occurring there. One of the critical things to put in any plan and as you execute it, you want to have a good set of advisors that are beyond even your purview, able to see where some of the changes are occurring. And so having those panelists, whether they be in the scientific advisory board or they be in some type of advisory oversight, can be really critical. And leverage those. Don't assume that you've got all the answers, that whatever your plan was early on is going to be the golden letter all the way forward. Incorporate their input and their feedback. Not only will they feel engendered by that type of engagement, but you'll ultimately have a better outcome. Technology is constantly evolving, and even though you've got perhaps one of the more novel approaches to a solution, be mindful that maybe the problem shifts a little bit. You know, we're harking back to the way cardiac surgery was performed for many years, which was in and of itself an improvement upon current heart care. But the ability to treat vascular disease and valve disease using new techniques and new approaches has dramatically shifted the way new technology is impacting patient care. I don't think anyone could have completely predicted that or anticipated it, but those that developed good, sound technology development plans and anticipated some of those shifts are the ones that are still successful today. And the others have kind of become just sort of a one-trick pony. And I know that's not your goal. So being able to keep track of those market shifts and to roll them back into your overall strategy is a key consideration when you're executing your technology development plan. Colleagues, do you have something to add there?
Just to underscore that, Chip, I can think of examples of companies that we've worked with from the outside who, for instance, envision their technology primarily being deployed in the ICU. And so there was an entire sort of market model built out about how many inpatient days are there in the ICU spent and how often is this particular condition that they were targeting, what is the overall prevalence of that condition in ICU patients. And one of the things that we found as we started to build a pilot and we started to talk to key opinion leaders about where and when this technology would actually be used, we found out that instead of the ICU, the emergency department was actually the place where our clinicians would want to use it most often. And so that required a sense of flexibility and an openness to feedback to sort of reincorporate new information into the plan on the fly. It didn't invalidate in any way what they were trying to do, and in some ways it multiplied the market for this potential technology, but it did require the company to sort of to understand that their initial vision wasn't necessarily going to be the same as it transformed and grew. So yeah, just to underscore that sense of being able to anticipate change and be flexible with the feedback that comes, especially when you're leveraging a partner to develop that feedback. That's why you're doing it. I always joke that a statistic's no good if it tells you exactly what you thought you would figure out 100% of the time. The best statistics, and this comes from sabermetrics, my background in baseball, is that you should be surprised 20% of the time. And so oftentimes when we'll work with these outside entrepreneurs, it is a good thing, in fact, that occasionally when we run pilots or we do validation, that they receive pieces of information that they otherwise weren't expecting. It doesn't mean that their technology is invalid. It means that we've been able to more robustly chart a course forward for them.
Just 20%. You're only surprised 20%, John? That's pretty good.
Well, if you're surprised a lot more than that, then you might have been a little off base to begin with.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Terrific. I think the next slide continues on our innovation journey.
Yep.
So when we started with that stylized straight line, I think this multiple inflection point curve more fairly represents the likely pathway towards the readiness of your technology to be consumed by the marketplace. One of the points we wanted to bring out with this graphic is that knowing that there are going to be these sharp rises in expenditure or investment, followed by perhaps some long runs of technology readiness, that's typical. Knowing where those inflection points are, that's where the key differentiating factors are, where I guess the really successful entrepreneurs earn their medal. If you're on the other side, if you're investing, ideally you would rather invest when you're going to see some great growth in technology readiness for a fairly low spend. But on the other hand, you do need to anticipate that there are going to be these rises. What we look at Cleveland Clinic Innovations when we're evaluating technology is we look to see what is the right investment to make. What is the most appropriate and will garner the highest ROI for an investment? And to invest there and not necessarily look to run the technology all the way to its greatest value. We want to know when to bring a partner in. And that takes a lot of experience and really a deep understanding of what the market is calling for. If the market is calling for a certain capability and you can demonstrate that capability with a fairly modest investment, then that's where you're going to get your greatest return on your investment. So, John, if you don't have more comments there, maybe go on to the next slide.
Sure.
And this is how we think about, and we hope any of you in the audience will think about, kind of breaking down the journey, the roadmap for technology development and adoption into a series of phases. where each phase will have some very distinct growth elements. They're all predicated one to the next. So we don't encourage anyone to be working in phase three if they haven't necessarily built a strong foundation in the earlier phases. But as we talked about earlier, having all of the all of those pieces in there that really allow us to build upon it are critical. What you'll notice in this slide is where all of the collector points are, where all the jumping off points are, where it starts to make sense as an entrepreneur for you to think about bringing in a strategic partner, for you to think about when your adoption curve is becoming very steep, and rather than making that full investment yourself, you're going to be well served to bring in a partner that can maybe do the heavier lift to get you up to the next stair tread, if you will. But we don't encourage you to do that early on. We encourage you to do that later, once you've got some real data to present, once you have some information that is going to be truly enabling for the marketplace. And to give you some examples of that, if you sit across the table from a potential strategic partner and you have but a patent and maybe some conceptual drawings, you're at a particular disadvantage as you discuss your ideas with them, even if you're under a non-disclosure, because what you're really demonstrating is what the market need is, and you're describing for a potential strategic partner where they should be investing. And I recognize you're trying to get them excited about your technology, but in fact, you're validating for them something that they probably already knew, and they aren't necessarily going to value your contribution in the same way that they potentially could. So being able to come to that conversation with data that represents actual use, maybe not in a human clinical experience, but in a seemingly well-structured benchtop experiment or a well-designed preclinical project, that can be very impactful, because what that will signal to the potential partner is how you have work through some of the technical challenges that they would have to work through, and it will truly start getting them to pay attention to you and start realizing, even if they maybe don't agree with all of your market projections, it puts enough thought in their mind that they need to pay attention. And so we encourage anybody we work with to go after the collection of that demonstration data that will really allow for the conversation to sort of tip more towards your side of the equation.
Yes, Chip or John, I guess when you're talking about kind of those meetings and with the potential strategic partner and kind of getting them interested in you, what type of timeline are you normally seeing between kind of meeting for the first time to actually engaging in conversations that could lead to agreements, strategic agreements with these partners?
Yeah, of course there's no hard and fast rule, Leah, but great question. And I would offer that you need to anticipate that potential partner will need time to digest and consult with their own trusted advisors. If it's a small group, that can be rather efficient. In other cases, it can be several months. And that's actually maybe a good sign that they are taking this seriously. You obviously have to maintain conversation. But don't expect that on a Monday you're going to present data or information and then you'll have a decision and a check in hand by the end of the week. That's completely unrealistic. We find that it's somewhere in the 2 to 4 month range between the time of initial engagement until the point at which you might have an option agreement in place, or you might have some type of a path forward that involves their strategic partnership.
Chip, I think that's fair. One thing I'd add there is that those time frames can vary depending on what the existing relationship is. So we, both through our alliance program and just through the normal course of working with industry partners out of Cleveland Clinic, we have a few more connections, and we are always sort of in the middle of several conversations with strategics. And so that allows us to not jump to the front of the line, but to be able to enter into those conversations with a background of knowing one another, trusting one another, having done deals together over the past. And so both the folks that we work with, that we are aligned together and we have agreed that we're going to try to ideate in specific spaces, but also just those folks, those strategics that we've worked with over time and have closed lots of licenses with, there is an ability to occasionally accelerate those timelines just based on the history of who we are and the work that we've done.
And I'll jump in too, because I think 2 to 4 months seems a little bit quick to me. But I agree, it's a very much a relationship basis for how quick you get from, I guess, the first conversations to a drafted legal agreement where you're agreeing to trade technology and money. So in kind of pharma industry, I've seen it take up to 2 to 3 years. And very, very much dependent on the novelty of the technology. If you're plowing a new path with a new type of technology that the FDA has never approved before, in that industry, it takes longer because none of the strategic partners have experience going down that path with the regulatory authority. But in other instances, it's much quicker. But I guess the other area, I'd like to discuss is kind of the different types of strategic partners, because I think in my mind, companies aren't just looking for one strategic partner. They're looking for a number of them that help with different facets of the company. So when you put the puzzle pieces together, they're a successful company.
So, Leah, I don't want to underestimate the value of the types of partners in this case. And when the puzzle pieces fit together nicely, it's a great observation. It's a great feeling. They just sort of lock in place. I can tell you that we've been approached by entrepreneurs or small companies before that have been trying to foster a relationship with a large market share player in the industry and are getting nowhere. And we pick up the phone and make a call, and within a week, we're sitting down across the table. And it often becomes a three-way conversation then. It's the technology provider, the entrepreneur or the startup. It's the strategic investor or the strategic partner. And then it's our group that is able to describe the impact that that technology will have in the marketplace. And it's that description of impact that is really going to often move the needle and tip the teeter totter, if you will, because what happens is we speak from a position of authority, we represent the market, we also have inside data which describes what the true costs of doing certain things are and what the likely impact is going to be for this new technology. So. Yes, the amount of time to get these deals varies across the board. Having the right people around the table can have a big impact. So I think the next slide talks a little bit about how to leverage different partners, and we've been talking a lot about this. And I kind of I'll reemphasize, and my colleagues I think will jump in here as well about. Thinking about how to align everyone's incentives. I mean, there's an old adage that says any good deal typically involves everyone going away from the agreement wanting. I don't know that that's necessarily the right message in all cases. I think a good deal is where everybody got something that they hadn't anticipated getting. out of the deal. And that can be the inventor, that can be the strategic partner, where they are all able to really garner some value that was not initially anticipated. And of course, there's typically in any negotiation a compromise that has to occur. But I think those are key things to consider when you're having that conversation, and do it with a group that has experience in that space, that maybe has either tried to work in that same space and brought technology to the market, or has maybe failed previously. And this is another opportunity to build upon the new knowledge they gained through that lack of success. But I think demonstrating the value that each partner brings to the table will allow for a fairly rapid meeting of the minds. And the biggest message here is that partnerships are a good thing, that they ultimately mean your technology is going to move along that journey in a much more efficient manner.
So I'll talk a little bit about, I apologize for the aesthetics of the next slide. There was an animation that didn't go well as it transitioned into some sort of static document. But to Chip's point about aligning with the right partner and stakeholder at the right time, there are some partnerships that you're going to enter into that are going to be short-lived and transactional in nature. And those tend to happen on the earlier stage of the technology development continuum. So when you think about, do I need a technology assessment or a market assessment? That's something that can be done in almost a fee-for-service consulting relationship. Do I need help on intellectual property or a regulatory strategy? Again, that's something that you would hire somebody to do that would advocate on your behalf and that would help in a sort of consultative fashion build a plan for you. Similarly with a key opinion leader review, especially in the market that Chip and I work in biomedical, that's obviously critical to understanding your market, understanding your opportunity. But those are things that you can do that are time-bound, that you pay for, and then you sort of walk away with a piece of information that then you can take to potentially a more strategic partner, a longer-term partner. So as you move from, to Chip earlier referenced a teeter-totter, that's what this was supposed to look like. As you move from those short-lived relationships over to the right side of the slide, you see some of the things that require more collaboration that will tend to be longer-term relationships that could potentially be strategic for your company, that could include things like investors. You get to pilots and clinical validation. I know here at the Cleveland Clinic, we are working with an accelerator plug and play to think about how can we bring in technologies from the outside that require some validation, but that ultimately allow us to solve our unmet needs. And so we're both aligning our priorities together. Joint development, a lot of the partners within our alliance program, they're bringing some fundamental IP, but our inventors are going to bring fundamental IP. So how do we merge those together and jointly develop solutions that are market ready? As I said, investment and equity, obviously that's a long-term partnership that you would want to think about. Or again, in our space, clinical trials, that's finding a partner or many partners to engage in a true clinical validation of your solution. And so these things take a longer time. They require more of a commitment between two or more partners, and they end up being more foundational to the direction and nature of your technology and company. Leah, I wanted you to weigh in on the legal components of some of these elements, especially on the further right side of this continuum.
Okay. And I think, John, you said further commitment, and the first thing that pops in my mind is, as a company is going through, especially those things on the right side, part of that further commitment is a dollar commitment just to getting the legal documents right to do those things and move forward. The pilots, the clinical validation, those may not take very much money. An institution, like Cleveland Clinic, if they're conducting a pilot study for you, is going to have a form agreement, where you're going to take that form, review it, and understand it from a business perspective, but hopefully also have somebody with a legal perspective review it for you so that you can understand some of the technical details of what you're agreeing to, you know, especially when it comes to indemnification clauses, you know, things that you're agreeing to where you may have future liability or, you know, what the ownership of the intellectual property that results from the pilot study is, those type of things to make sure that the legal language, which, you know, while at least myself as a lawyer try to make it as plain English as possible, isn't always plain English to all business people by any means. You know, and then moving into joint development, equity and investment, not only is that, you know, legal dollars spent to get the agreements right, but it's also time. You know, I would say a joint development agreement might take a month or two to negotiate. You know, not just drafting the agreement, but going back and forth with the business terms. And during that negotiation phase, whether it's the joint development or an investment, it may feel a little bit negative because we're always asking the what ifs and we're trying to protect from the downside scenario. So we have to write the agreements in the what if everything goes wrong scenario so that both of the parties are protected and they really understand the structure of what happens if things go wrong. Because honestly, as a lawyer, if things go right, no one ever picks up the agreement again and they don't know what it says. But those areas are very structural and kind of firm as far as kind of the legal backbone of the documents that need to be in place before the parties will really engage and take the business steps forward to do the projects that are being contemplated.
Thanks, Leah. And so from that perspective, there are some challenges to partnering, and we wanted to talk a little bit about what those challenges are, both from the perspective of a large strategic partner, whether that's the Cleveland Clinic or some other strategic organization, and then obviously, what are the challenges for startups and entrepreneurs? So this is not meant to be an exhaustive list, but it's meant to sort of get your minds working around why is this not moving as quickly as I want it to move? For instance, I'll just speak from the perspective of Cleveland Clinic, but I think that this goes for other large potential partnering organizations who are looking for innovation from the external world. There's a sense that it's not core to who they are. So at least at the Cleveland Clinic, you'll remember that we are first and foremost here to deliver superior patient care. And so when we bring in a technology from the outside that we maybe want to pilot or validate, It is with the understanding that that is necessarily disruptive to what we're actually here doing most days. So if you bring in a new thermometer sensor into the OR, that's going to cause workflow disruption. That's going to cause challenges with the surgeons. It's going to make things initially take longer, and it's going to confuse some of the staff as to why we're doing that. And so this sense that, yeah, there's R&D work to be done, but we're here trying to run a hospital and take care of patients. That can be a challenge. And with any large organization, there's the core business that's being undertaken, and then you bring in an entrepreneur from the outside who has a new solution. That can feel disruptive. Another thing I'll say is that large organizations tend to be more risk-averse, and necessarily what a lot of entrepreneurs are asking for is to take a risk, try this new thing, try to learn more about a technology that may in fact disrupt the technology that the large partner already has on the market. And so these inherently conservative large organizations are less risk tolerant than obviously many in the entrepreneurial community. And then lastly, I'll speak again only for the clinic, but we are engaged in wanting to hear from entrepreneurs outside of the Cleveland Clinic. As I said before, we've engaged with Plug and Play. We have an externally facing group within Innovations that Chip and I are both a part of. We've started to build out programs to drive external innovation to help solve some of the unmet needs of the Cleveland Clinic. But all of those efforts require us then to vet opportunities and vet lots of opportunities. And again, that's not the core to who Cleveland Clinic is and how we tend to spend our resources. And so we tend to work more slowly than the entrepreneurial community, who has a great idea, wants to drive it forward and get it into clinical practice, tomorrow. So similarly, on the other side of the ledger, some of the challenges are really the inverse of those I just described. Startups and entrepreneurs, just the same way that large partner organizations have to vet opportunities, startups and entrepreneurs have to identify the right partners. It's not always easy to know who the right partner is to go to, whether you need a potential clinical champion before you approach a strategic market entry partner. Similarly, with attention units, a startup or an entrepreneur is dedicating all of his or her time and energy to one particular technology or product or company, whereas these partners have broad and diverse interests, capabilities, requirements on their time. And so the disparity in attention units between a partnering organization and a startup organization can be daunting and can cause those timelines that Leah talked about to really start to go longer and longer, which can be frustrating for the entrepreneurial side. And then lastly, leading into the speed of execution. I think large environments also have large corporate legal environments that, as Leah said before, can take some time to get through, to move paper through an organization of 60 or 70,000 employees can take some time, given that you have to get the right sets of eyes on all of these documents. And for an entrepreneur, that can be frustrating, especially when there's a certain amount of runway that you have from a funding perspective and you need to get some of these agreements in place. And so aligning the right partner doesn't necessarily mean you'll always align on the right time frames. You might have the best strategic partner in the world lined out, but it might not work from a timing perspective. And so understanding from the entrepreneurial perspective that you have to be flexible when it comes to identifying and working with partners. These are all challenges that are inherent to doing this. I will add a note of optimism. Like I said before, large organizations, despite these challenges, are committed to working with entrepreneurs because they see it as the sort of lifeblood to continue their growth pattern. Certainly, Cleveland Clinic, as is evidenced by our dedication to all these external innovation programs, recognizes that not all good ideas come from the Cleveland Clinic, that we are going to have unmet needs that need sourcing from the outside world. So while we're committed to doing this type of work, it doesn't mean that it'll always be easy or smooth, but the fact that the commitment is there in our organization and in other large organizations that I know personally through our Alliance program is a positive for entrepreneurs. Oftentimes it's just identifying the right contact, or maybe more importantly, the right set of contacts to start to move any of these conversations forward.
And just a couple quick adds, if I may. So the first on the startup entrepreneur, the identifying the right partners. I think as a startup or entrepreneur, this in some senses can seem insurmountable. How do you find these people? And once you know who you think the right company is, how do you get in? And how do you get a conversation? You know, some of that's just picking up the phone, going to conferences, but it's also those accelerator programs that are popping up everywhere because if you get in and they have the right focus, they can launch you into a connection with the right organization that can help move you to the next stage. And the other one I wanted to talk about is the speed of execution. So I think that, you know, one of my frustrations in my practice is I always see, or I typically see entrepreneurs doing things, trying to save money, but sometimes when they try to save money or they go too fast, they cut corners, and they don't pay attention to kind of in my perspective, some of the legal details, the paperwork details, and how they grow their business. And they want to do things, let's say, quick and dirty, you know, making contracts on the back of a napkin over a lunch or over a beer. And that's all well and good. But I think to some extent what I've seen in the industry is that people are growing, I guess the industry is growing up. We're not inventing catheters in garages anymore, and we're not making contracts on the back of napkins. You know, there's a lot of attention from industry partners looking to partner with startups and entrepreneurs for this kind of culture of quality. So even if you're a five-person company, looking professional, having all your I's dotted, your T's crossed, knowing what you don't know, but taking good care of the things that you do know.
It certainly would seem daunting listening to this last set of discussion points that an organization would exist that was both in the right position to leverage your technology, but also have the openness and the willingness to do so. I think what I've heard today is how impactful the time spent to put together the right plan and how impactful the time spent to identify the right partners can truly be. I want to give you the strong sense that those partners do exist out there and that the spade work you do to put the plan together will be impactful. My recommendation is you not be adverse to reaching out and talking to groups that are in this space. I think you'll find a real positive return on that investment. And for all the reasons we've discussed today, it may take a little longer than you expect, but the rewards will be there.
So we're right at the top of the hour, so we'll quickly go through the rest of the presentation, which is really just two quick commercials for upcoming events. The first of which I'm sure Chip and John will say a few words about, but I'll start off. It's Cleveland Clinic's Medical Innovation Summit at the end of October in Cleveland. I have to say it's my favorite conference of every year, and I go to every big conference, but people are a lot more accessible at this conference to have conversations and to really kind of dig a little deeper, because it's not 40,000 people. It's just a few thousand people that are very interested in the field, if this is the field you're in.
Thank you, Leah.
Thanks,
for the
Leah.
Yeah, I would just add, this is one of those conferences where we bring together folks from all across the continuum we were talking about earlier today. So there are entrepreneurs there, and in fact, the entire first day of the summit is now dedicated to a startup challenge, but we also bring investors and scientists and physicians and large strategic organizations. So this is one of the few events that I'm aware of anyway throughout the year that really seeks to bring all of that ecosystem of commercialization together, and that we bring it together in Northeastern Ohio. And I think, Leah, thank you for putting this series together. If there's anything that this series is dedicated to, it's sort of raising the awareness level and the bar around Northeastern Ohio commercialization. And so that's something that our summit is dedicated to as well. So thanks for allowing us to pop this in there.
Oh, not a problem at all. And then I'll skip to my commercial, which is just the next event in this series. Next month, we'll be talking about preparing your company for financing. We're pairing with another local organization, which is an investment bank. So we'll have an attorney and an investment banker talking about kind of the key items that investors are looking at when a company is going out to market and trying to raise equity capital, and how, I guess, the steps to best succeed if that's where you're going, what you're looking for. So thank you to both Chip and John for your time and your expertise. I greatly appreciate it. And we'll let everybody go just a couple minutes late, so thank you for hanging with us. Feel free to reach out to us with any questions. Our emails are up on the slides, and you'll also get a follow-up email from us with a copy of the slide deck and a link to the presentation. Thank you.